Catholic Radio in Metro Detroit. This is 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
I am back with Dr. Jeffrey Wallen. We're going to talk some more about the life of amazing, remarkable man Winston Churchill. Jeff Wallen is President Emeritus, founder and president of the American Academy for Liberal Education. He has served as Division Director at the National Endowment for the Humanities and Program Director at the Robert M. Hutchins Center for the Study of Democracy. He's published a book on Churchill entitled By Ships Alone, Churchill and the Dardanelles. But we've already talked about the Dardanelles. What we're going to talk about today is we're going to talk about the build-up during the 30s, maybe even in the late 20s, to the Second World War and Churchill's role in warning not just Great Britain, but the world, really, about the Nazi threat when many wanted to simply let Hitler do his thing and appease him, his quest to take over basically all of Europe. Jeff, welcome back to Church and Culture.
Thank you, Dale.
Now, Churchill had several moments in his life when he thought his career was over, correct?
Yes. Well, so, certainly where he thought it was over, and you're right, a couple of others where it came close to it, yes.
But one of them was a prelude to his return in which, at a time when Germany was beginning to rearm.
Right.
And nobody literally wanted to recognize it. So tell our listeners about that. And, you know, why was it that Churchill was alone in wanting to warn Great Britain in America of what was certainly to come?
Well, you're right, Bill. Almost no one wanted to recognize and admit what was going on. In fact, it reminds me a little bit of the situation in this country during the 70s and early 80s, when there were people who did not want to admit the Soviet buildup when it came to the placement of American SS-20s in Europe to counter them and so on, because it was frightening to admit that the Soviets might have had us in their sights, as it were, that they might wish us harm, and that they were building up the power to do so, is a difficult thing to admit. Because it is true. What do you do?
Especially coming off of World War One, right?
Right, right. And that was the problem he faced, is that World War One was so devastating. And remember, it was shocking, too, because the wars of the previous century tended to be rather small wars. And when men marched off, both in England, France, and Germany marched off to war in the autumn of 1914, they all thought they would be back home by Christmas at the latest. And it turned out to be a very different war, much longer, much bloodier than they expected.
Well, it was the bloodiest war in human history up to that time, wasn't it?
Up to that time, yes, but of course they had another war in waiting, and that became the bloodiest war, which is World War II. But I think that we have to have some sympathy for the difficulty of facing the reality that Churchill warned about. And I think he had some sympathy with it, too, although he thought the duty of a statesman far outweighed his fears and the willingness of all of us to sort of hide from a building crisis to face up to. And every time he tried to warn about this and say this is what we must do and so on, he was dismissed, often laughed at in public, because nobody wanted to deal with the facts.
Yeah, if someone recalls the wonderful movie with Albert Finney and Vanessa Redgrave, The Gathering Storm,
yes.
It actually begins with a scene of Churchill in Parliament speaking of two things. First of all, his rejection of the India policy, meaning the independence of India that was being recommended by the Prime Minister, but also of the rearmament of Germany, and he was just being completely scoffed at on both counts.
Yes. And for one thing, people tended to look at the India issue through moralistic eyes. It's bad to have an empire. All right? And you can see the reason for that. We tend to think that's true. After all, we fought the American War, Revolutionary War, to break off from one. And we have very little sympathy with empires. But Churchill's view was, first of all, speaking from within an existing empire, not an expanding one. But he was also dealing with the fact that he saw a coming war. And he wanted to brace for it with all of the resources at England's touch. And that included India. He didn't want India to be the place that had to stop the German armies if necessary, but if that had to be, at least to provide some kind of stop. Remember, he spoke about that. If they cross the sea and come after us, we may be left holding broken bottles to fight them with, and we'll do it to the death of the last man. But after us, there are the colonies, or former colonies, including the United States, that will come to our aid. So he didn't think that giving India up was wise. Also, he thought it was immoral. People have trouble understanding that, but Churchill had very serious and long-held principles. And let me give you an idea of this by going back to prior to the 19th century, when Churchill talks about Mohammedism. This isn't India, but of course in the fight over India, eventually it becomes Mohammedism versus Hinduism. But this is a very nasty kind of statement Churchill makes. But let me read it just for a moment. How dreadful are the curses which Mohammedism lays on its votaries? Besides that fanatical frenzy, which is as rational and as dangerous in a man as hydrophobia in a dog, there is this fearful, fatalistic apathy. The effects are apparent in many countries. Improvident habits, slovenly systems of agriculture, sluggish methods of commerce, insecurity in property, and just wherever the followers of Mohammed rule or live. A degraded sensualism deprives this life of its grace and refinement, the next of its dignity and sanctity. Individuals may show splendid qualities, but the influences of the religion is paralyzing. It does indeed teach men how to die. It should rather teach them how to live.
Wow.
Dying is a trick very few people have been unable to pick up.
Sounds like he understood ISIS completely.
Exactly. And now, no one would want to talk that way today because they'd be called a racist all this. But I think Churchill makes it very clear. You know, I'll read something much later, very short, that will indicate that he was talking about a principle, and the fact that a particular race or religion spouted it didn't necessarily mean opposing it was racist. All right? The real issue was always for Churchill between barbarism and civilization. Now, if you don't think there's a difference between those, if you think that's an invented difference, which is often what people think today, especially the educated, our young students coming out of college and university, then that kind of language is hard to listen to. But it's the kind of language that made Churchill capable and effective in standing up to Hitler, because he wasn't just talking about Mohammedism as being non-European. He was talking about the difference between civilization and the attacks on it, whether it came within Europe or not. He thought the Nazis were even worse, and they were Germans, some of the most cultured people in the world, than the Muslims. I don't know why I didn't say it properly. But all through his career, he hung on to that distinction. And one of the reasons we have trouble understanding people like that is because we no longer allow ourselves to speak with the same kind of language.
Well, with the directness and boldness.
Right. Well, think of the president's speech last night, if I may say so, Dean. My own view, by the way, is that was a very, very good speech.
I agree.
You never hear the word noble anymore. You never hear the contrast between civilization with barbarism. It's hinted at our enemies cut people's heads off, right? But no one quite wants to bite this problem and hold on to it because we don't have a language sufficient for it. And the reason for that is that the hallmark of the last two centuries has been to strip our senses of bite and to make virtue, the highest virtue, a matter of being nice, getting along.
Niceness, yes.
Right? And,
yeah.
And Churchill couldn't do that dealing with the Nazis. He had to deal with them as they were, just as he did the communists after the Russian Revolution. That's one reason why a lot of people didn't like what he said. They thought he was being a racist. That he wasn't being a racist, not at all. Now, let me read you one other thing, if I may, before getting into the late 20th century. This is from 1918, July 22nd, 1918. This is a speech on the Declaration of Independence. All right? Now, he makes the argument. He said, if we were fighting for more territorial gains or in a dynastic or commercial quarrel, these would no doubt be matters for bargaining. But this war has become a conflict between Christian civilization and scientific barbarism, between nations where people own governments and nations where the governments own peoples, between systems which faithfully endeavor to quell and quench the brutish, treacherous, predatory promptings of human nature, and a system which deliberately fosters, organizes, arms, and exploits them to its own base aggrandizement. We are all erring mortals. No race, country, or individual has a monopoly of good behavior or good or evil. But this war is nothing less than a conflict between these forces. And he goes on to say that Germany must be beaten. But this is an interesting part that he follows up on, and that is an assurance. He said, Germany must be beaten. We must know that she is beaten, must feel that she is beaten. Her defeat must be expressed in terms and facts which will for the all time deter others from imitating her crimes. So, now, this is interesting. But the German people have this assurance that we claim for ourselves no natural or fundamental right that we shall not be obliged in all circumstances to secure for them. We cannot treat them as they have treated Alsace-Lorraine, or Belgium, or Russia, or as they would treat us all if they had the power. We are bound by the principles for which we are fighting. Whatever the extent of our victory, the German people will be protected by these principles. The Declaration of Independence, as all of it implies, must cover them. When all those weapons of which they have trusted have broken in their hands, when all those preparations on which they lavished their scheming energies of 50 years have failed them, the German people will stand protected by these fundamental principles of right and freedom against which they will have warred so long in vain.
So he nailed it. He nailed it from the very beginning, as he did nail the Russian Revolution. And
yeah.
There were a lot of British elites, Cambridge, Oxford graduates, who fell in love with the Russian Revolution, with Leninism and Stalinism. He wanted no part of that either.
No, not only that, he intervened. He was still First Lord of the Admiralty in the Russian Civil War.
That's right. British soldiers.
A little bit later than that, but yeah, he wanted to intervene and try to stop the Russian Revolution. Not because he didn't think that people had a right to revolt, but because he knew what the principles of the revolution were.
And that was rejected. The prime minister let him have a little bit of money to do that.
Right.
But basically shut him down.
Right, right. Didn't follow through with it. Now, again, one has to understand the other side, and that is Russia was an ally of Great Britain in the First World War, as it was in the Second World War. And people had a sympathetic feeling for absolutely barbarous acts because of that connection. Same thing happened in the Second World War. You know, we went around talking about Stalin, calling him Uncle Joe. This is one of the most vicious butchers of human beings that ever lived. But because he was our ally, we not only had to make room for his actions, we had to convince ourselves in a way that they were democratic too, you know, aiming for the same thing.
Was Churchill ever fooled by Stalin?
Never. Never. I think he sometimes thought that he could deal with it better than he could. But no, he didn't have any doubts about the Bolsheviks. He always thought that Bolshevism was based upon the rule of the white ant. And it simply took away all individuality, all scope and action for a free and independent mind, that it was a great and evil movement to resist. But he never wavered in that. Now, that doesn't mean that he wouldn't work with them, as you know. I mean, he was having the Russians as an ally in World War II. So it wasn't something that just blinded him to the practical realities. But my point here, and in reading these passages, is that what I see throughout Churchill's attempts to wake England up in the 30s is a very powerful combination of an adherence to clear first principles without turning it into moralism. Clear first principles backed by fact. That's what gave power to his speech. That and the fact that he spoke a language that, and then it was common English language, frankly, the language of the King James Bible, of Shakespeare, and so on. And you could speak of such things as noble and ignoble. It's a terrible thing that we've lost the ability to do that. And now we talk about, even in that speech last night, well, our values will prevail over their values. Well, that's pretty weak, soft speech.
You can't say the truth will prevail over evil.
Right, right.
Or falsehood.
All evil. Now, fortunately, both recent presidents, four of them, have in fact called what ISIS was up to evil. And it was amazing they were able to even use the word. But beyond that, they very seldom tell us why it's evil, what it represents, what the world would be like if we gave up and the world was turned over to them. Churchill would talk about what it meant if that happened and what it would mean to their own people, not just Britain, America, but what barbarism meant to their own people, however much they may have approved of it. And I think that distinguishes Churchill's rhetoric, from that of just about anyone else at the time, even those who were very much with him. They didn't have that concept of what was worth fighting for, of what, besides the sort of visceral thing, you know, we will fight to protect ourselves. And he certainly relied heavily on that. But it was that vision of what was at stake that distinguishes Churchill from anyone else in World War II. I mean, read Eisenhower, you don't get it. Read Roosevelt, you get some of it. But you don't get it from our people today, even the great people who lead the country. I haven't seen a speech like that given by General Mattis, for example, or any of the other great generals surrounding President Trump. That doesn't mean they don't believe that. I think they do. But it's hard to carry on when you can't speak of these things and say what's evil without someone accusing you of, attacking women or some other group or something like that.
Or imposing your white privilege. Your white male privilege.
Right. Your white privilege.
You've got more white male privilege than anybody I know, Jeff. I say that as a very old friend of yours.
Yes. The point is not to win, but to deserve to win. That you can't control events. You can control what you deserve and what you stand for. And that's what worries me about the failure of some people to comprehend Churchill. To me, it's a failure to understand reality in the 20th century. And that faces us all the time. Churchill would not have spoken much different to be spoke today as it did when he did. You know, people say, well, he was a Victorian and all that. Well, to some degree, yes. But he cut right through that because what he spoke of meant as much now as it meant in 1918, even if he would have trimmed some of those words a little bit out of some sort of sensitivity, I don't know.
But by the way, Jeff, I wanted to tell you, I did a little digging, and you probably know this, but in 1932, very early in the game, Churchill actually went to Munich to meet Hitler, according to this article, that he went there with the intention of meeting him, that it was set up by a man who became very, very close to Hitler, Mr. Hastengel, who became one of Hitler's closest friends, and that they were all at dinner. Hastengel was hosting, waiting for Hitler to arrive, He never arrived, but Hastegel went out in the lobby and saw Hitler meeting with someone else and said, "Why don't you need to come in and meet Winston Churchill? He's here. He's waiting for you." And Hitler said, "No, I have more important things to do."
Yeah, and I had thought that the trip itself, though, was for other reasons. You know, once he was there, he agreed to meet with Hitler. But that may be wrong, because that was very early on, and I can't think of any reason necessarily why he wouldn't meet with him at that point.
But what this particular writer, this was out of Der Spiegel, by the way, what this particular writer says is, what difference might it have made if Hitler had gone in and had dinner with Churchill in Munich in 1932?
Well, all right. Think of what that means. Why would it have made a difference? Remember that just before the war broke out, in the 2 years prior to that, one of the difficulties was that neither Hitler nor Mussolini had any respect left for Great Britain or the Western Allies at all. Right? They thought they were weak, decadent, and when it came right down to push comes to shove, they would fold. So the only hope of having the two of them meet is that it's very unlikely that Hitler could have had that opinion of Churchill. And that might have made a difference.
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating. I personally didn't know about that that moment when, and evidently, Hitler, I think, isn't it fair to say that Churchill, even in 1932, already had the measure of Hitler? But the fact that he would go to any trouble to meet with him says something about the man's courage, if nothing else.
Well, I think Churchill was originally open to either Mussolini or Hitler coming to power because of the terrible shape their countries were in. I mean, they really needed to do something. They were on the ropes. And so having a strong man come in is not necessarily a bad thing. But once Churchill understood Hitler's racial theories and all of that, you know, then he knew what he would be up against, and he would oppose them all the way. But he didn't oppose him just because he was uniting Germany. He opposed him because of the kind of government that he wanted.
Well, it was the pogroms, the anti-Semitism,
yep.
the early concentration camps that were built, and one kind of sad story inside of all this is that the young man inside the government who fed Churchill classified documents about the buildup of the German military so that Churchill could write and speak to the British people about a buildup that they didn't know about, which was being kept from them. This young man committed suicide later on, when he felt that his career was going to be ended by those who opposed Churchill and opposed a war with Germany.
Who are you speaking of?
I'm talking about Ralph Wigram. He was in the Foreign Office, and he was able to give confidential information to Churchill about this, for example, the size of the Luftwaffe and the growing number of pilots who were being trained, and also about the thermite bomb that they were preparing to drop on London.
Right. What I'm a little confused about, though, is I don't think he committed suicide. Where did you come up with that?
It's in the movie The Gathering Storm. It's in the movie, and I'm looking at his Wikipedia, and it says his sudden death is somewhat mysterious. He was found dead at his home. I guess the movie decided to make it definitely a suicide. There is a letter from a friend who suggests that he knew it was going to be suicide. So, but the point being that this young, bright young man took a huge risk to his own career and family, to feed Churchill these classified documents so that he could make the case to the nation.
What happened was that Churchill was out of office in the 30s. However, he kept himself before the public by writing approximately one newspaper article every 2 weeks, in addition to all the other things he was writing, his history of Marlborough and all of that sort of thing. And so he was always writing these articles, had a very wide readership, and they spanned everything from theoretical issues of mass effects, modern life, and so on. I recommended a number of these to you a while back, so I think you know what I'm speaking of. They're collected in Thoughts and Adventures. But a lot of them were about the growing German menace. So what happened as a result of that, he started having people come to him and give him information. People who were responsible for various activities in the government. Ralph Wigram was one of them. All right, and he lived not very far from Churchill's residence. He could really walk right across some lawn to get there. Wigram supplied a lot of Churchill detailed information, because when he started raising these issues, the first thing that the government did was deny that there was any serious danger. All right, now that leaves aside the larger overriding issues having to do with disarmament and everything. We can come back to those. But Churchill would say that you promised us that we would have parity, or you promised us that we would have so many squadrons and all of that, but we don't. We don't have them. Or if we have them, they can't fly, or they haven't been manned, or something like that. He got a lot of that information from Ralph Wigram. And after Wigram, there were a couple of others, Wing Commander Tor, a few others, who did risk their careers. They risked being prosecuted under various government acts that made it unlawful for them to share some of these things with Churchill. But they came anyway, because they realized how serious this all was. And Wigram did not have good health, unfortunately. And I don't believe that he committed suicide. And maybe he did. You know, who knows?
Well, it makes for a better story, obviously, from the film's point of view. We're Jeff Wallen, going to take a short break, come back and talk about the years as Winston Churchill got closer to taking office as Prime Minister. We'll be back in a moment.
He had it all that comes with being a football hero. Hi, this is Peggy Stanton. Please join me on Power from the Pews when my guests, Danny and Claudia Abramowitz, talk about Danny's dramatic conversion from addiction to alcohol, fame, fun, and money to a 30-year apostolic ministry to men. That's this Saturday at 11 a.m. and Sunday at 9:30 a.m. on Ave Maria Radio and AveMariaRadio.net.
Light of the East, weekends on Ave Maria Radio.
I'm Father Thomas Loya. This week on Ave Maria, we pass the liturgical baton with the help of our friend Nepsis. He is not a person, but something that can help us become a person that partakes in the divine nature.
Saturday evenings at 8:30 and Sunday mornings at 9 on 990 WDEO, Ave Maria Radio.
Hi, this is Father John Ricardo, inviting you to join me as we explore some of the deepest questions that arise in our hearts, questions that shape the way we think, the way we speak, and the way we live. For all of these questions, Christ is the answer.
Our individual and corporate relationships with the Lord, our relationship to the church, the precepts of the church, our relationships with the world and the culture that surrounds us. Father Ricardo discusses these things and more, all from a Catholic perspective on Christ is the answer. Listen to Christ is the Answer, Wednesday evenings at 8, Saturday evenings at 6, and Sunday mornings at 11 on 990 WDEO, 1440 WMAX, and AveMariaRadio.net on the Internet.
Christ is the way, the truth, and the life. He is the image of the invisible God. He points us to our destiny. He reveals the dignity of the human person. He is the one who makes known the Father. Christ is the Answer.
Dr. Jeff Wall, and we're talking about the years before Winston Churchill actually became Prime Minister and led his nation against Germany in the Second World War. How exactly, Jeff, did Churchill manage to rise to the top? Because if my reading of his life is correct, nobody liked him, with the exception of his closest friends and his wife, and sometimes she didn't like him. How did he actually end up to be the last man standing and become prime minister?
Because, in fact, he had many friends he had made throughout his long career prior to 1930. And many of them still liked him, came to the house. You know, they had dinner. And these are some powerful men who did not want him in office. But they still maintained close relationship with him. He would still send them copies of his new books and so on. They would write back flatteringly how much they enjoyed them, all that sort of thing. So he had this very wide acquaintanceship. And he had the respect of a lot of people who did not like some of the issues he stood for. People who were convinced that the age of colonialism was over. Anybody standing in the way was just standing in the way of progress. And then especially when disarmament became the leading edge of opinion in Great Britain, in Europe in general, and the United States. When that happened, it was very difficult for him to make his case without seeming to offend people. All right? But that doesn't mean that they all cut off relations. These people spent a lot of time together. I mean, England's a small place, London even smaller. And with the dinner parties, everything else, there were very few who were really bitter about it. Some were. Samuel Hoare and a few others were. But in general, not. So I don't.
Well, he was making himself unpopular on various fronts. We've already talked about India. We've already talked about his trying to wave the red flag of warning with Germany. He was pushing for rearmament at a time when the then prime minister didn't want to spend the money on rearmament. He was also making a nuisance of himself with those newspaper articles that he was writing and with his very long-winded speeches in Parliament.
Yes, that's right. But there were also people writing him saying, I can't say this out in public, but that was brilliant. He was right. So, because they were feeding him information, and a lot of people, what took place is that it wasn't just a matter of Churchill arguing for recognizing the threat of Germany and then the government denying it. The government was denying a lot of his facts, but his facts tended to be accurate because he got them from the same sources that the government got them from.
Right.
And that drove him nuts. But the reason he got them is that these people who were tasked with gathering this information about armaments in Europe and so on, they're the ones that came to him voluntarily, risking their careers and recognizing that Churchill might be the only person able to stand up when everything is said and done and not have a whiff of defeatism around him. Because just about everybody caved in to the general feeling of disarmament. I mean, to think back the last 20 years in this country, 30 years, and how unpopular you could be at a party by not standing fair, square, and for nuclear disarmament immediately.
Oh yeah.
Okay.
And by the way, I left out one big item that he was unpopular for, and that his support for the abdication of King Edward the Seventh to marry the woman he loved.
Well, yes, but it was a bit different than that. What he finally decided is he had a personal attachment to the king, and he wanted to save him and the monarchy by figuring a way for him to leave Mrs. Simpson and then take up the monarchy. Everyone else thought it was too late, and besides, he wouldn't have done it anyway. Well, Churchill was just wrong about that. And, I mean, you asked earlier about how did he ever come back into power when there were a lot of powerful forces against him. Well, remember that what became evident that Germany was definitely going to war, invading Czechoslovakia and Poland and so on. The British had few people to turn to who hadn't been compromised by either being fanatical for disarmament. Remember, Anthony Eden, for example, argued a few years before this that France's army was too big. All right? And when Churchill called him on it, Churchill said something about Eden wanted to have France's army. Eden responded, no, he's got that all wrong. I just wanted to go from 490,000 men, you know, to 227,000 men or something like
that's
that.
That's half.
Yeah, we're close to it. Wasn't
yeah.
half. But the central truth was there. And that was Eden. It took him a while to come around, too. So everybody's trying to appease. And the person who keeps saying you can't do it that way is not going to be someone they care much about. It's like, you know, showing that the emperor's not wearing clothes. Let me give you a short thing. This is in 1937 now. We're getting pretty close to things. And Jeffrey Dawson, the editor of the Times, wrote to someone on May 28th, I should like to get going with the views. I'm sorry, it's hard to read this right here. I should like to get going with the Germans. I simply cannot understand why they should apparently be so much annoyed with the Times at this moment. I spend my nights in taking out anything which I think will hurt their susceptibilities and dropping in little things which are intended to soothe them. So if this was going on in 1937 and 38, you can see how someone coming up and saying, you're a fool for doing this. Because Churchill argued, by the way, that one of the things that was most dangerous to do was to give Hitler the thought that he wouldn't be resisted. Remember, part of Churchill was trying to do is put together a coalition of smaller countries. And we tend to think of them as very small, but that's not true. Czechoslovakia army was huge, and it could have defended itself under the right circumstances. And the Polish were not feckless either. But Churchill's view was, you keep bowing down and letting Hitler take what he wants. Why do you expect him to be satisfied with that? If he thinks he can take whatever he wants, he will. If you stood up to him in 37, early 38, he was prepared, as we now know, to back off.
Right.
And the German military would not have supported him if he hadn't. Their problem was they didn't like Hitler, but he kept being right. He kept saying, we can take it. We're going to march right in and take it. And his generals would say, well, be careful now. I mean, it's not that easy to pick it. And besides, we've got to deal with France and Britain. But when France and Britain didn't do anything, okay, that just led Hitler to be bolder, and it meant that his critics could no longer criticize him because he'd been proven right so much.
Was
that coalition?
And was Churchill's first great feat the Dunkirk evacuation?
I suppose so. Well, no, his first. The most important thing is he stopped the British from giving in. I mean, there was a very strong sentiment that the German military machine could not be stopped. Okay? Okay, look, it was just cutting through France like warm butter.
They were doing 100 miles a day.
Yeah. And so a lot of people wanted to say, well, you know, let them have that, you know, and we'll get along with him. We'll figure a way to get along with him, and everything will be all right. Too bad for the French and the rest of them. But again, that kind of moral cowardice was rampant simply because the alternative was what? Fight World War II. And had an inkling of what that might be like. So the first thing he did was tell everyone,
we're going to fight World War II.
Yeah. He said, well, the interesting thing is the word he used, is you asked me what is our policy? Victory.
Yeah.
Now here they are almost on the ropes. You know, Europe's caving in all around them. They've got this minuscule little expeditionary.
In fact, he said to a friend that he thought they'd both be dead in 3 months.
Well, he might have said that. But it didn't matter. I mean, it mattered, but what did that have to do with the right policy?
That's not what he's going to say to his people.
Right, right. And if he said it, you know, who knows? He might have said it tongue-in-cheek, too. But
right.
Let's go ahead. We're all going to be, you know, dead in 3 months anyway. Because it's not a characteristic term with him. And, you know, someone asked him in a dinner party, said, you know how strong the Germans are and everything. And he said, you know, are we really supposed to resist them? What would happen if right now they landed some boats and came towards us? And Churchill looked around and said, well, there are some stores of arms around here. We'll get those arms, and we will make a defense. And we may die fighting, but we certainly aren't going to give up.
I read where about this time he was out in the backyard practicing with his own revolver.
Yeah.
In case they did, in fact, invade London, he was going to get out in the streets himself.
Absolutely. It kind of reminded me a bit, in a funny kind of way, of that scene in the film Patton, you know, where there's this air raid, and Patton runs out with his revolver.
He starts shooting at the planes going on with his pistol.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, it's kind of madness, but, you know, what else is going to stop it except people like that?
You know. There is one quote from 1935, which troubles me about Churchill,
yes.
And I'm sure you know what I'm talking about.
I'm not sure.
Okay, well, the quote is that he says of Hitler that he can accept if Hitler strengthens Germany, its economy, if he sort of solidifies Central Europe internally, and stops there. But by 1935, he knew, I mean, Churchill knew what was going on with the Jews, and
right,
he knew...
he wasn't going to stop there.
Hmm?
That he wasn't going to stop there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But this is a direct quote, and do you think that he was just saying this as a kind of like, well... A possible scenario?
Well, I think what it was is that no country has the right to go out and start wars with other countries just because it disapproves of their policies, however heinous they may be. There has to be self-interest involved because you're taking the young men of the nation and sacrificing them for what? For a mere moral purpose? To make some other country better? No, there has to be a danger to yours as well. So if Hitler had a very limited ambition to make England great, but it really didn't have anything to do with going further than that, that would have been a very good case of not trying to stop it, although you would speak publicly against it.
But I don't think that Churchill ever really thought that Hitler would be self-contained.
No, but that's a comment that shows you that if he were to limit his appetites in that way, then one perhaps would allow him to do what he was doing. Maybe you could then say, well, it's his affair. I mean, take a look at Russia. People for many years, especially the left and center, were very angry at America resisting Russia's expansion. You know, why not let them do whatever they're going to do, or interfering in Bolshevism and calling it names and so on. But the problem with Bolshevism is it was an expanding theology or ideology. It wasn't going to let us alone. And that makes it far more of a danger than if it's simply limited to its own sphere, however evil it would be on its own. As a statesman, you have a duty to protect your country far more than you do to protect the rights of others.
By the way, I found the citation. It's a 1935 essay he wrote, Hitler and His Choice,
mm-hmm.
where he expressed the hope that Hitler, if he so chose, and despite his rise to power through dictatorial action, hatred, and cruelty, might yet, quote, go down in history as the man who restored honor and peace of mind to the great Germanic nation and brought it back serene, helpful, and strong to the forefront of the European family circle.
Yeah. That's an essay, I think, actually directed towards Hitler himself.
Ah, yes. Personal letter kind of thing.
Yeah, it really was. You know, you think you're going to be this great man in history by pursuing these policies, but you're not. You want to be a great man in history. Make your country great again, powerful again. But all this other stuff, you know, let's kill all the Jews and let's invade every country around us and all that sort of thing, that's not going to get you there.
One of the first decisions Churchill made as prime minister in the war was to bomb the French fleet.
Yes. Yeah.
And that, to me, is a that's got to be one of the toughest calls he ever made.
Yes, it was.
Tell our listeners that story.
Yeah, well, the French fleet was in Oran, Remember, now you had the French divided between two governments. Now, the Vichy government, which had pretty much given in to the Germans, and what they got back from it is Germany stopped invading. And the fleet was under their control in Iraq, in North Africa.
It was under the control of the French Vichy government.
Yes. And Churchill was afraid that it would fall in the hands of the Germans. And, of course, it would then be added to the German fleet strength. Well, the lifeline of Britain, remember, Britain's an island. It can't survive if it doesn't have incoming food supplies and other supplies. It has to have that to live, especially in a war. So the most important thing is to keep its naval strength and to prevent an invasion. Well, that would have been harder to do if a large French fleet were added to the very large, powerful German fleet, relatively large and powerful, not as powerful as the British by any means. But the problem was he tried to get the admiral in charge to give the fleet over to the British, but he refused.
This was the commander of the French fleet simply would not negotiate.
Would not do it. And, you know, Churchill thought for a moment that if he got a hold of them privately, personally, he could convince them. There were a lot of maneuvers going on, but he couldn't get him to do it. And that meant, what was he going to do? Allow the fleet to fall in the hands of the Germans or not? Well, the only way to prevent it then was to bomb it.
Well, actually, you know, Duff Cooper went to Casablanca to try to negotiate it.
Yeah. Like I say, he really thought if he could just talk to the admiral personally, he could convince him to do this, but he couldn't. The admiral left, and Churchill tried to follow him. I mean, it's not really funny, but it seemed funny at the time, to see what he could do to save the fleet for Britain.
But, and there, we're talking about, at the end of the day, we're talking about six aircraft carriers destroyed, one battleship, two battleships damaged, three destroyed destroyers, one destroyer grounded, one tugboat destroyed, but most of all, 1,297 dead and 350 wounded, and that's of our allies, the French.
Yes, right. And Churchill knew that he would pay a big price for that. France wasn't going to be happy about the fact that the British were killing their sailors. But he thought he really didn't have any choice, and I think he's right. I mean, it's hard to imagine.
How has history judged that decision?
I think on his side. I don't recall reading anything in recent years about that was the wrong thing to do. I mean, they were at war. And it's hard to imagine what the argument is for not doing that except saving the French lives. But we're talking about something much larger than that. We're talking about the opening of a world war.
I read a rather long description of this event, and what I read is that the French commander, Marcel Bruno Ginsoul, was simply too proud. He didn't want to hand his ships over to the Brits. I mean,
he was a Frenchman.
Yeah, I mean, he just didn't want to, you know, hand his command over. And
that's right.
There were all kinds of back and forth, and I don't think that he believed the British would actually open fire.
You're probably right, but he was wrong. He wasn't aware of what was at stake. By the way, there's a parallel with World War One. You know, at the opening of World War One, there was a Turkish ship, naval ship, in British yards, and built by the British. And as soon as the war broke out, Churchill, who was First Lord of the Admiralty, there were two of them, actually, German ships, Churchill refused to give them back to Turkey and incensed the Turkish. But he was damned if he was going to give two more ships over, essentially, to the Germans. So he didn't. So there was a precedent.
It seems to me one thing that distinguishes Churchill his entire life is that he was not afraid to send men to their death.
No.
And even the experience of World War One, he himself being in the trenches, by the way, 8 miles away from where Corporal Adolf Hitler was serving.
Oh, is that right? That
yeah.
I didn't know.
8 miles away. That he did not how shall I say, shy away from it the way other members of the post-World War I generation did.
Well, it's true. But the odd thing is you have to compliment that. You have to also realize that more than anyone else, Churchill was trying to save lives. The generals always wanted to go right at them. You know, let's charge in there, especially the Americans. You know, let's land in France in 1941 or 1940 or something like that. And will you beat them? Well, that would have been a very bloody affair, bloody enough as it was. And Churchill had to hold them back because, for the same reason, World War One, he wanted not to have a head-on battle on the Western Front, but to use the flanking maneuver, which would leave the enemy somewhat stunned by being attacked that way and allow them to win without a huge slaughter of men. So it's true that if men had to be sacrificed, Churchill knew that. He was a soldier. And he would give the right command. But it has to be placed in the context of his overall belief that major destruction of life of the kind we're talking about on the front lines of World War One and on the east, the Russian lines of World War Two, that was very, very bad for the countries. It destroyed their manhood. It destroyed the ability of men to believe in goodness as well as evil. It destroyed their whole outlook.
One last question about Churchill's relationship to the English people. I think it's pretty clear that in the time that Churchill is trying to rally the government and the people to oppose Germany, that the popular will, majority opinion among English people, is they didn't want to go into another world war. They were still recovering
right.
from World War One.
Right.
How long did it take, and how did Churchill win them over?
Well, he did it primarily by his speeches. His speeches, which were a marvelous combination of the moral high ground and meticulous attention to detail. Look at how his speeches are organized. They're point after point. They're an argument. This, this, because of that, this. And he would build his case and hammer home what had to be done. And the other thing is that people knew that they could trust Churchill not to turn and run. I mean, that's one of the good things that happened about his support of India and his support of the king. They were both very unpopular. Now, Churchill destroyed his own chances for coming back into the government by holding those positions. And people knew that he would do the same thing to fight the Germans. He would not look at some immediate chance to curry favor and not do the right thing. I think that was critical to the British people turning to him. He may take positions you don't like, all right? It doesn't matter.
You know, the young John F. Kennedy was living in London with his father, Joseph Kennedy, who was America's ambassador to England. And Kennedy commented that Winston Churchill sent the English language into war.
Yes, he did. He lined up the English language. He sent it into battle in a way that's hard to calculate to see, except when you read his sentences. And they became almost like physical things. But doesn't that fit in with a man of action whose every action is defended by thought and reason?
Well, we've come to the end of our time for this show, Jeff, and I want to thank you for once again for being a guest here. I've been talking to Dr. Jeff Wallen, who is founder and president emeritus of the American Academy for Liberal Education, Washington, D.C. I'm going to continue reading about Churchill, reading about the politics and the principles involved in the decision to fight and the decision, the determination to win, and we're going to come back and talk again. Thanks for being with us on Church and Culture, and to all of you listening, I'll be back at this time on this day next week.
If you have any comments or questions about church and culture, you can contact Deal Hudson at dhudson@avemariaradio.net.